This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Bonnie North. Pregnancy can be incredibly difficult. Sometimes the hardest part is not knowing what's really happening to the fetus inside and whether or not it's developing into a healthy human being. When Dr. Aoi Tomita Mitchell was pregnant, she was faced with a serious dilemma that could have risked the health and safety of her fetus. She and her husband, Dr. Michael Mitchell, took their problem and created a solution, the Harmony Test. Both Drs. Mitchell sat down with Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about their work.
The Harmony Test is a test that is given or performed on pregnant mothers as a non-invasive way to look for problems with the fetus, particularly genetic problems with the fetus. Specifically, it looks for trisomy 21.
Now, when I talked to you about this, you said part of the reason you developed the test, you had your own difficulties during your pregnancy.
Yes. This test was developed out of a personal need, and
Would you like me to tell that story?
Yes.
Go ahead. When Aoi was pregnant with one of our children, she underwent a test which was commonly performed at that point to look for problems with the baby. And she tested into a very high risk category for having a genetic problem. And it was compelling to the clinicians that were taking care of her. And we lived in Kentucky at the time. And they brought her to the amniocentesis suite, where an amniocentesis is a, as many people would know, is a way that you can make a definitive diagnosis for a problem with the fetus by placing a needle into the womb and aspirating some cells related to the fetus and then doing a genetic assessment of that. The problem with that is that it's associated with the risk of fetal loss, and we certainly did not want to lose our baby, and we were not going to terminate if there was a problem. But in Kentucky, in order to get the services that you need, if you were to have a problem, you did need to have a definitive diagnosis. The other issue for us was that we knew that there was a problem with the surveillance test that was available at the time, that it had a really challenging or poor sensitivity and specificity, that in the situation where you could get a result and it could lead you to need amniocentesis but not really be indicative that you had a problem. And so we decided not to undergo amniocentesis because of the risk of fetal loss. And then the risk of fetal loss was about 1 in 200, which is about the same as the risk of mortality with a heart surgery on a baby. And so knowing that, we just didn't want to take that risk. And so Aoi spent the rest of her pregnancy thinking about this problem. She had a background in genetics and genetic research, and she came up with a really ingenious solution whereby you could take a sample of blood from the mother and look at something that is called cell-free DNA, which is basically fragments of DNA that are circulating in the mother's plasma, and then you can actually see the component that's from the fetus and analyze it. And using that technique, she thought that this would be a way that you could make a diagnosis definitively. So she developed that idea, and we together applied for a grant from the Wallace Coulter Foundation, which likes to see collaboration between clinician and scientists. And we got enough money from that grant to start and develop this concept and start a small clinical study, which we performed up here when we were recruited to Children's Hospital and to the medical college.
Mike was incredibly supportive during this time. It was hard not to want to have the amniocentesis, but he was extremely positive and encouraging. And actually, my graduate work had been in human genetic research and specifically in rare variant analysis. So it made this particular scientific challenge relatively straightforward. It just kind of all came together when there was an opportunity to apply for grant funding to work together and to try to solve this challenge together.
I would be remiss if I didn't ask, was your child all right?
Thank you.
Yeah, no, yes, our child ended up being not having the genetic problem that was suspected that she would have, and just sort of cementing our commitment to seeing if we could develop this so that other women and families would be assisted with this. So we did launch the clinical study here, and it worked really well. And as a consequence of that, we committed to trying to bring this to the general population and recognize that through a process of stumbling, figured out that the way to do that was actually to create a company and raise money, and that was the way in which you could actually get this to people. And so we did that.
How widely available is this test?
The test is very widely available and performed regularly. I think that it's approaching replacing that serum test that I had taken, which had given us the false positive. So we are thrilled about that.
You know, you mentioned you took a serum test. What makes the Harmony test more accurate?
So the serum test was really based off of hormone levels in the serum, whereas the Harmony test is based off of, Mike was describing, cell-free DNA that's present and circulating in the maternal bloodstream.
And hormones would be less reflective of what's happening with the fetus?
Yes, there's a lot of variability with that, and much of the, I think, references were set against population that may have looked different than myself, whereas a DNA-based test would be very quantitative. You could really assess the fetal genetics that would be present, the mother's blood.
So how is the test used? Who are the likely candidates of people who would take the Harmony test?
A mother who's expecting, a woman who might be expecting. Initially, it was targeted to high-risk pregnancies. At the time, I was considered a high-risk pregnancy because I was, I believe, 34, 35 at the time, so an advanced maternal age, which
doesn't seem very old.
No, not anymore. But now I think it's becoming more widely used.
So you've also developed another test more recently. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Sure. I'm a pediatric heart surgeon at Children's Hospital. And what I do is operate on children with congenital heart defects, so defects of the heart that they're born with, anatomic malarrangements. And this congenital heart disease is the most common form of defects. It affects about 1% of live births. It's also the birth defect that's associated with the highest mortality. So it's the number one cause of infant-related mortality that's associated with a birth defect is congenital heart disease. Fortunately, these days, the vast majority of patients that are born with congenital heart disease are effectively treated with surgery. There's been a lot of development in our field, which has pushed it to the point where there's probably somewhere between a 2-5% mortality of all comers. So that means that in general, patients do really well. However, the patients with the most severe variants of congenital heart disease can go on to, despite successful surgery, can go on to really fail from progressive heart failure. And the last solution for these patients in that situation is heart transplantation. And heart transplantation is used both in pediatrics and in adult patients who have heart failure in this country. And the number of patients that are requiring that and are able to get it is actually, fortunately, on the treatment end, is increasing. So there's about 3,500 heart transplants that are performed in the U.S. per year in 2019, and about 520 or so were done in pediatric patients. That is only possible because of the generosity and the sort of the foresight of all of us who live in the United States and think about donating organs for this kind of medical use. And as such, all these donated hearts are extremely precious, very precious resource that needs to be preserved. So it's really an amazing technology because a patient who's near death can literally undergo this operation and then within a week be up and around and recover to near normalcy. And it's really beautiful to see that kind of success. What we have to do is preserve the health of those organs. And what plagues that treatment is that they can succumb to rejection. And rejection takes a number of different forms. We talk about cellular rejection, antibody-mediated rejection, acute rejection, and chronic rejection. And we have to monitor for the rejection. And when we detect it, we can treat it with steroids or increasing the doses of different immunosuppressive therapies. And the way we monitor rejection today is by taking patients to the catheterization laboratory, where we place a needle in the vein and pass the catheter up into the heart and actually do a cardiac biopsy, or we call it an endomyocardial biopsy, where basically jaws come out of the catheter and take a small piece of the myocardium, and it's pulled out. And then we look at it under the microscope and look at to see if there's inflammation, and then grade the inflammation and also determine if it's an antibody-mediated rejection or if it's a cellular-mediated rejection, and then give appropriate therapy based on that assessment. The problem is that that's an invasive test, and it particularly if you're a child, that's a very intimidating thing to undergo. But for any of us, I think having that procedure done is significant. More than that, it can be dangerous because in some cases, we inadvertently biopsy the valves, the tricuspid valve, or you create an injury to the myocardium that results in fluid or blood coming out around the heart. And in the worst case scenario, that can actually be life-threatening. There are other issues. The rejection, when it occurs, it can occur as a patchy process. So it's possible that you can be having rejection and the site of which you sample the heart is not the site where the rejection is occurring. And so you can miss active rejection. And so you can get what's called a false negative from that. Finally, there's a problem with what we call inter-observer variability, which means that one pathologist, despite excellent training and skill, can look at the specimen and make a different call than another pathologist. And so this has been studied and reported, and it's a fundamental limitation of the biopsy read and that technology. So all those things together make it compelling. It's really an important goal, almost the holy grail of the field of rejection surveillance, to come up with a non-invasive test that would be accurate for the detection of rejection so that you wouldn't have to undergo the biopsy and you could use the test as surveillance and really pick this up early.
So how do you skirt around, you know, really getting a tissue sample? Because when you're talking about it, it seems like, well, wouldn't that be the most direct way of you know, finding out if something's wrong? But as you mentioned, there are a lot of issues with both doing the procedure, but also analyzing what you get. So how do you avoid that?
So the idea came because I had a particular patient of mine who had had a very complex form of congenital heart disease and had a successful operation to repair that in the sense that they survived the surgery and went home. But over time, their heart failed, and we thought she would need a transplantation. But at that point, she had no more vascular access, so she couldn't undergo that kind of biopsy and surveillance. So we had the idea, getting directly to your question, that perhaps if we could look at the DNA from the donor heart that was circulating in her serum, in her plasma as a recipient of the heart, just like we could see the fetal DNA circulating in a mother, and if we quantified that amount of DNA, that perhaps the amount of DNA would indicate injury to the donor organ, and that would be an indicator of rejection. And her hope was that, geez, in her case, if we had this test, then she could be listed for heart transplant. But as it stood, she couldn't be listed because she didn't have vascular access. So there would be no option for her. So that was the case that really inspired us to try it out. And that was the idea. And we did the pilot study, and we're really pleased to see that it worked in a group of about 80 patients, 80 children. That was published in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology and allowed us to get subsequent funding from the NIH. We were awarded $3.3 million from the NIH and NHLBI to pursue this at 8 centers in a much larger multi-center study.
Now, I don't know if you can answer this question because I know there's a level of patient privacy that you have to observe, but was your patient all right in the end?
Yes. Actually, she's phenomenal and amazingly has recovered to the point where she doesn't need a heart transplant. And she's just a beautiful, really intelligent, thriving girl now. But there are many others just like her who actually have needed needed heart transplant, and many who have undergone that successfully, and a few who have now used this test to actually help them with the monitoring.
So in some ways, it sounds like this test shares similarities with the Harmony test, in that it's finding, you know, this, I'm going to screw this up because I don't quite understand DNA on this level, but finding these little pieces of DNA inside of their blood plasma. How does that work exactly?
So the cell-free DNA component is much harder to quantify because it's about more than a thousand-fold less than what you typically expect from a simple blood draw where you're obtaining DNA. So that's the challenge. And then when we're just talking about very small percentages or even less than that and trying to quantify the non-cell-free DNA, that really becomes a technical challenge. And so that's really takes a tremendous team to be able to do that accurately and reproducibly.
Now, this is something that you've developed for people who are getting heart transplants, but is it something that could also work for other organ transplants or even other limb transplants? I know some people get arms or legs.
That's a great question.
And we're studying that in lung transplants currently, and we're seeing that it seems to work very well. And in theory, it could apply to all solid organ transplants, potentially even have use in bone marrow transplantation.
So what's next for you? I know you're still doing some studies, of course.
Yes. Well, we were extremely fortunate to have had this tremendous research opportunity to work and understand how cell-free DNA works. The medical college has been just a wonderfully supportive partner in trying to bring this technology back to the patients. And so in order to do that, that did require, just as we had done with the prenatal effort, required us forming an entity. So that endeavor, it's an entity in Milwaukee. It's called TIE Diagnostics, which stands for Transplant and Immunology. And it's here in the Milwaukee County Research Park. And we have built out a molecular diagnostics reference lab, which we've been very fortunate that Milwaukee has the talent, and we've been able to attract the talent to try to make this technology available.
And I'll add, I think it's broadly applicable, and that's very exciting to us. However, it came out of this really profound clinical need in a particular child, and is so important in the field of pediatric heart transplantation, and working with the Herma Heart Institute, which is where I work, and program that really champions the ideas behind taking innovations in medical care and then figuring out how we can actually apply them to the care of children is what drives us. So we're hopeful that this will make a meaningful difference to the kids right here in Milwaukee who need heart transplant and then branch out from there.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Mitchell, thank you both so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you very much, Joy.
Dr. Aoi Tomita Mitchell is a professor of surgery and biomedical engineering at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Dr. Michael Mitchell is a pediatric cardiothoracic surgeon at the Herma Heart Institute at Children's Hospital of Wisconsin. Together, they share a laboratory in the Children's Research Institute, and they have founded two biotechnology startup companies, including TAI Diagnostics here, based in Milwaukee. They spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers, and you can find out more of our conversations with doctors from the Medical College of Wisconsin at wuwm.com.